Welcome to Disrupt Disruption, a series of intimate interviews with global thought leaders and practitioners operating at the intersection of business, leadership, and technology. We're discussing all things innovation and disruption and how to not only survive but thrive in these times of exponentially accelerating change. Trusted by CEOs, founders, and leaders globally for the latest take on business models, methods, culture, and leadership, we cut to the chase, debunk the hype, and get real. You're in great company. I'm your host, Pascal Finette, co-founder of Be Radical. Hey, everybody. Pascal here. We are back with another episode of Disrupt Disruption. Today, I am stoked, and I can use that word in earnest, to talk with Cecilia Tam, also goes by Cece. She's the co-founder, principal, and future synthesist at Futurity Studio. We'll talk a bunch about that. Previously, she co-founded and created a collaborative co-working space and community in Barcelona. She worked for Telefonica Alpha, which is the European version of Google X. She's a highly accomplished speaker. She was born in Hong Kong, lived in Macau, now lives in Barcelona, so brings a whole interesting background with her in terms of multicultural perspectives. Cece, I'm super stoked to have you.
Thank you so much for having me, Pascal.
Let's get started. I'm so curious because you're truly the embodiment of what I would call a futurist. You work on super crazy stuff and a little bit of inside baseball. We just talked about plants, which basically mint their own money and sell their artworks, which you have created. And maybe we get there in due time. But how do you even, you personally, think about disruption? How do you define it for you? Where's your starting point?
I think for me, a lot of what we do has to do with bridging seemingly very unrelated and even far off ideas and really test them out and see if there's any next steps to it. And this is how we test. And the more we test, the more iterations that we do and more things that are opposite that we bridge together, the more learnings that we get and the more that we can expedite these type of different experiments and in disruption.
I know you work with your own projects, you work with big corporations. How do you think about bridging that gap between crazy idea and totally wacky out there and big corporation coming to you and saying, this is all great, but we also need to make money?
We actually learned a lot coming out of Telefonica Alpha. And part of it is because there is this core about being able to create a business that is sustainable. And when we are working with innovations and disruptions, we often look at a couple of different perspectives. And the first and foremost, actually, it's the business aspect of it. Is it going to be a sustainable idea? And the second one, which is also related to business, is that is this related to that particular business, that industry? The second thing that is important is whether or not it is connected and whether that particular industry has leverage and can really use that particular idea. The third thing we look into is if whether, you know, how much impact it will create. And we're here talking about sustainability and social impact and whatnot. And a couple of other less, I guess, prioritized, at least when we were at Telefonica and Alpha, are questions like IP, technologies, and future visions. And so together, we create an index that will allow us to assess whether this is something that is applicable for that particular.
And walk me through a little bit of your process in terms of identifying opportunities, new opportunities. How do you come up with them? How do you suss them out? And how do you decide go, no go, taking them forward?
When we're talking about projects, especially projects that are in the longer horizon, so we're talking about 5, 10, 15, 20 years, we're not talking about immediate kind of return of investments. Those, we have worked out a kind of a metric systems, right? Whether number of users, how much money we're going to be able, and those you can calculate more or less. But when we're working on long-term projects, we need to create new ones. And sometimes that is based on not a perfect system, but we try to calculate how many people that will be impacted by that particular outcome. But those things are in the air, really hard to suss out, especially when they're long-term type of calculations. So what we do is we pair with things that we can calculate that is more immediate. And we do it by iterations. And we do many, many, many iterations. And we incorporate many perspectives in order for us to get closer and closer. Because the idea isn't to have a perfect vision of what that could be. The idea is to eliminate as many unknowns as quickly as possible so that we can make decisions on that next step. And so closer to whatever that desired goal that we wanted to arrive to. So I don't think there's a magical formula. This is something that depending on what trajectory and what vision they have, we have to keep dancing into closer and closer to that goal that we want. We use this exercise called backcasting, right? So you have this vision and then it's never that. It's, you can create that roadmap as pristine and as precise as you have imagined. It is never going to happen that way. It's never straight line. It's never linear. And every first step that you take, you're going to learn something new and you need to reincorporate and recalculate and recalibrate. And being able to do this in an agile format is the only way to go.
You said backcasting. Can you say a little bit more about how does backcasting work? How do you use it? How do you use it for your clients to better understand for our listeners the power of that particular tool?
Absolutely. So while forecasting is looking forward from where you are now, backcasting is if you have a point in the future, say 10 years from now, and you have this idea that you really want to build, say, for example, autonomous hotels that can navigate on its own. Then you create a couple of different intermediary steps so that you can start understanding, well, what am I going to do tomorrow so that the trajectory of that particular future will happen? And the way we approach this is that we have this future vision in mind and we break it up into components. And sometimes you look at the particular feature and sometimes you look at the purpose, right? A prime example of this is that if you, say, wanted to build a car in the future, I'm going to make this a simple example. If you're going to build a car in the future, if you look at the features, you can say, oh, well, I want to build the battery, the car seats, the shell. And then you break this down and say, well, tomorrow I can build the engine. Versus if you wanted to use the purpose-driven, the purpose has to always remain the same, meaning that the purpose of this car is to go from point A to point B. And regardless of what steps you're going to take, the first step always have to be, how can we navigate and place a people and give it mobility from point A to point B? So it could be a skateboard, and the second step could be bicycle, a motorcycle, and so on and so forth. So you break it up into these parts, and you can also combine, right? So maybe you arrive to a certain point and you say, no, now I have enough minimal viable parts that could create a whole, and you can combine and go back and forth. And this is something that is very useful in the sense that a lot of the future exercises or future kind of tool, we have this vision of the future, but we have no idea how to get there, or it is very hard to imagine how to arrive. So by breaking this down into parts and understanding how to connect these parts from where we are now, it's absolutely crucial.
And how do you come up with the future idea, the vision for what it could be, either be it a product, service, or as you said, even a purpose from where you are today? Because how do you come up with the idea that a plant could own its own money and create art, which it then sells as an NFT on the open web? Where does that come from? Clearly, you're brilliant, but how can we as mere mortals probably apply some rigor to that?
I have to thank you, actually, Pascal. Because this was an exercise that we did together way back when we were at Singularity. And there are a couple of different names to it. There's the Disruption Map, there's the Futures Wheels. And that's basically, it has been a tried and true methodologies to understand and then map out particular. And so for those who aren't familiar, basically what you do is you put a particular idea in the center and you start thinking about the consequences that particular idea might have. But we pushed that a little bit further. We developed our own methodology called Synthesizing Future. And we use that as a center tool to map out what that future space could look like, but using the same principles. And so thinking about different consequences, and we color code them into negative and positive and even neutral consequences. Because for us, those consequences then can be translated to either an opportunity, a risk, or somehow you need to develop a solution for it. If we push hard enough, those then can allow us to see what kind of opportunities and or solutions that we need to come up with.
Interesting. One of the criticisms we hear every once in a while about the Google Access approaches in this world is it's all pie in the sky. It's great if you are a organization which has oodles of money, you can just spend the money on it. And if something comes out of it or not, who cares? Now, I believe there's value and societal value at the very least in this, because we're pushing the art forward, right? We're pushing the state of the affairs forward. But if I am a corporation, I'm a company which actually has some obligation towards shareholder value creation, keeping my people well fed, how do I bridge that gap between pie in the sky and really building for the future? How do I cross that chasm between the two venues?
I think there is a very clear shift in our discourse about futures these days. I have observed in the last couple of years, and that shift has been that we've always considered the future domain space, or the future study space, has been very much predominated by forecasting and foresight, which is great and is absolutely needed. And in the last couple of years, I've noticed that that shift has been turned into how can we proactively be the builders of these futures? And that discourse led us to shift from, you know, crossing our hands and waiting for that future happen to how can we be the leaders and the creators of those futures? And I think companies like Google X, they're amazing because they do have the resources to build and make those futures happen. But more and more, what I'm seeing is that not only big companies, but us, we also have that capabilities because the innovation capability and capacities have been growing as well. And how do we really go about building these futures? You build them. You don't talk about them. You don't theorize them. You build them and you test them and you get insights and you build again and you create another iterations. And that this is how you move closer and closer to it. And I think a lot of people are a little, maybe apprehensive is too strong of a word, but they might look at machine learning and then or 3D printing even, and they think that, oh, it's really, you know, far off from what I do. When in turn, these technologies are actually really simple. Well, simple in the sense that they have been democratized with different tools, with open source, and it's really leveraging a lot of these tools. And even quantum algorithm, I've learned that you can download in Python a quantum algorithm module and start, you know, playing with simulations right on your computer at your own home. Really understanding that these tools are there for us to test and build those possible futures. It's something very empowering, and I think people should really build up on their future literacy and future building capability.
As someone who spends a considerable amount of time in the future, and the actual future, not the 2 year out future, like the let's make the website look a little nicer or add a button here or there. When you look at say a corporate client, what is the argument for you? What do you tell them? Why should they care about anything beyond the immediate horizons, the 2, 3, 4, 5 years out? Why should they care about something which is 20 years out in it?
I would say there are two separate answers, and they're very much related. And the first one, I would have to say that it's very much related to what had happened in the last 2 years, which is COVID and Corona, because that shifted the expectations from a lot of companies thinking that they're in a safe harbor when all of a sudden all of this uncertainties and disruption had happened. And a lot of the companies had no means to or struggled to remain relevant, right? And so all of a sudden they're like, well, what should we do? How can we navigate this space? How can we answer it about or tackle the uncertainty? But there are no tools out there. So companies are beginning more and more to accept the fact that they need to have this culture and this tool into the company in order to build resiliency into the companies, right? And the second discourse, I would say, everything that we do, all of the exercises with foresight, forecast, backcasting, and future imagination, all of those things, it's a way of, I call it rehearsal. We're rehearsing for the future. And there's absolutely no loss to it, right? The more you rehearse of the different scenarios that can come, the more prepared you are. And so the more prepared you are, therefore, you are going to innately be more prepared when that particular unexpected future comes. And it won't be unexpected anymore because you have already rehearsed. So those two come in hand together, understanding that maybe it's not COVID, maybe it's another situation that we have to confront, but being able to have the ability to rehearse of multiple different scenarios will get us much more prepared for this unexpected future, and as well as a future that is changing much faster than we have ever seen before.
I love that point about the dress rehearsal. It makes absolute perfect sense to me. And quite frankly, it's the first time I heard it being expressed in that way. And I love the analogy. If we talk a little bit about the yin to the yang or the yang to the yin, when you see organizations embark on this journey, what are the common pitfalls? What do you find is the common stumbling blocks for them? What gets in?
I think one of the major difficulty is that they don't yet see how to get there. And by how, I mean, there are multiple different variables that are needed for companies in order for them to get to that future. First, they need to have the cultural kind of mindset to understand, okay, this is an opportunity for them and they need to incorporate. Second of all, they need to have the capacity within the company. They need to have people that can be the champion or the mover and shaker that can keep those projects going, especially if they're long horizon, right? Because if you can't immediately get return from it, you need to have an ability to and bring on board everyone else that needs to be on that journey. And then the third thing is they need to remove the fear of seeing this as we need to protect our core, because this is naturally what you do if your company and you're under stress, is that, well, let's protect our core and try to understand that, oh, if we don't rehearse for the future, we're going to be doomed. So it's a shift from this mindset of protecting us as a core, as a survivability mindset, to one that is more about opening up and building resiliency into the company. So those are the few things. At the end, it's really not about resources, right? Companies have the resources to be able to do this, they should. And it is a question of really changing their belief system in understanding that the long-term horizon investment, they're actually super valuable for them. All of those rehearsals, much more valuable to any number, any stock market prices, any of those very volatile and very immediate, I guess, satisfaction for the company, right? Those are at the moment kind of a metrics, but incorporating that future, it's priceless.
And how do you take something which you have prototyped, envisioned, created in the classic time horizon 3, like out there in the future, and you now decide, okay, you know what, like, let's pull this forward, let's actually do something, the timing feels right, let's do something about it. What have you found is the steps you should take there to actually make this work?
That is a great question. I keep coming back into this process of make and prototyping, because once you put it in the hands of people, once you see how people react to it, once you get the feedback, direct feedback of users, then you have insights. We talk about futures a lot, but we don't really have an understanding of this project that we have been working on about a plan and the bot. And it seems really far future, but it is something that we can actually create now. And so getting that insights is first and foremost crucial for us to understand, well, is it tomorrow? Is it 10 years from now? Is it 50 years from now? And if it is 10 years from now, but we really want it to happen today, can we make it happen today? And what is lacking? And what it is that we need in order to make that happen if we want it to happen? And so no longer are we waiting for a particular future to fit that project horizon for us. We have, as companies and as individuals and as innovators, the tools to bring that future closer to us if we want that to. I will pull this example, probably not the best example ever, but the Musk and SpaceX, right? Who would have thought an entrepreneur could, you know, go into the space industry and flourish with it in such a short period of time? And he managed and be able to create a very sustainable model for rockets to come back and land and make it reusable that wasted NASA, who had been running these space programs, have not been able to. So I'm really curious to apply this mindset of incorporating and making, pulling those future closer to us by creating the future now.
How do you weigh this with the maturity of technology? Because I believe history has shown us that it is very easy to be too early, to be too believing in a particular technology as it's not quite right yet. You look at virtual reality, which has been around for decades, and just now about comes into its maturity. Even Elon Musk with SpaceX, the particular technology, the fins, which allow him to re-land those rockets, were invented by the Russians in the 50s. So all that stuff is old, right? Same goes for self-driving cars. I mean, there's these pictures, depictions of self-driving cars, which we had in the 50s and 60s already, where you saw families playing games while the car drives itself. And granted, we're still not quite there yet. How do you think about maturity of technology, how do you assess it? And how do you get the timing right? Because that feels like it's the million-dollar question there.
You're absolutely right. So I'm sure a lot of people have used this framework called the three horizon. We use that and we expand that a lot. And the very first question that we ask, whether, you know, coming from the imagination side, so the idea side of things. So you came up with an idea. The question you ask is, well, is it even scientifically possible? Where are we on that curve? And if a scientist or a couple of scientists have proven that you can do X, Y, and Z, then you shift it to the second horizon, validation of the second horizon. And then you ask yourself the engineering question, well, can we do this at scale? So to give you an example, the first question of science, let's say culture meat. Can we culture meat inside a Petri dish? Great. We know that we can. We have proven that, right? And the second question then you ask is, well, can we do this at scale? Not quite, right? So we're building bioreactors. We're able to make a couple of kilos at, you know, a certain time frame, but not massive scale, right? Then you ask yourself, can we create a sustainable business with this technology? That's when it's become a commercial product, right? And then in between, you can always ask yourself, well, the legal question, well, do we have the policy in place? Do we have the legal framework in place to make this a mainstream project? And then there are other, I guess, layers that you can add as a framework to understand. There's the cultural question, how will people adopt this particular product or service? And so you can really break this down and really try to understand how these, every single one of these layers could be pulled closer or further and getting closer and closer in understanding that horizon. And that is pretty much driven or structured the same way as the PACE layers by Stuart Brand, which we use as a Bible here in the office. And he has a similar layer of nature, which is science, culture, infrastructure, governance. All of those layers are the same layer systems as we have mentioned.
If I rewind our conversation to the beginning, I am an executive at a company. I'm super stoked about the future now. I'm getting excited about it. I want to prototype it. What do you say to me? Where should I start? How do I actually go about this?
The very first step you should take is the ideation. This future wheel disruption map that we borrowed and created our own proprietary one, we're calling it Futurescape. And basically, it's literally creating a map of that future space. And that is the first step that we do with all of our clients. Because if you have a couple of very creative individuals in the company, as well as bring some external ones and do a brainstorming exercise with between 5 to 10 people, you can get a pretty substantial mapping of 10 years from now of a particular space. Of some of them will be ideas, other one will be fears and concerns, other ones will be applicable for a particular geography, and even other ones that are very, very far-fetched and some are safer, right? You get a range of different aspects from ideas to facts to concerns to all of these things on a particular map. And you can, you know, extend it later. But that is the very first exercise. Within a couple of hours, you see, well, this is what so-and-so have been thinking about in that space. And this is what potentially could be a massive risk for the company. And you get this pockets of ideas, then you can then decide on, okay, well, what do we do next? Now we have this, what do we do next? And so yeah, it costs almost nothing, a couple of hours and a couple of people gathering, and you get all of these almost like having their brain and their ideas into a map that you can move forward to. I often encourage them to do this exercise internally first and then expand outward to incorporate more people, because the more people that do this exercise with you, the more perspectives and the more resilient you're building the map, right? So imagine you all of a sudden you invite someone from Asia doing this exercise. You're going to start having ideas that you wouldn't had before. I definitely think that this is the single first step that people should do, which is a map. And like any other venture, like any other travel, when you arrive to a new city, what do? You look at the map, and this serve as the map.
Cece, I love this conversation. I have one last question for you, because you are a futurist. So I need to know, what are you excited about the future? What is stuff you're currently looking at as in, I'm getting really excited about this. I think this is going to really change a lot of things. This is something we should pay attention to.
the topic that I've been very, very much invested is this topic of autonomy. And it is the project that I started when I was in Telefonica, is what I continued currently in Futurity Studio. And I'm looking at this from the perspective of, we have our laptops, we have our phones, we even have our smart speakers at home, and they are gaining more and more capabilities and capacities. But what if then we start asking ourselves questions like, what if the bot one day would have autonomy? And what does that even mean, right? And so we start pushing ourselves these questions. Okay, well, if a bot has autonomy, does it have purchasing power, economic power? Does it have its own bank account? Can it vote? Can it travel? Can it have citizenship? And all sorts of these questions then begin to pop up. But then if we start translating this and say, okay, well, if a bot can have autonomy, can a plant have autonomy? So can we then build in these capabilities and capacity inside the plant? Then you start questioning, well, can a plant have ownership? Can a plant have bank accounts? Same question, right? But also same concerns. We talked about the word that replaces racism, but for plants. Do you call that planticism? If a plant has autonomy and it becomes a citizen, will they have planticism, you know, in the future? And then you can really push these ideas, you know, really far out. It's a topic that I'm really excited, because I think that we as humans have been putting ourselves in the very center of all the decisions, you know, whether it is for the rest of the planet, the rest of the universe, and whatnot. And I feel like the question of autonomy then we can start thinking about these other organisms, animals, plants, fish. What if they have autonomy, and what if they have the same right as us? And how will our future society then could make decisions as a whole that is not human centric? And this is a topic that I'm very passionate about.
Cece, our minds have been blown. I think I will think for quite a while now about planticism and what that means for the political party system around the world, and citizenship for plants, which we probably, given the climate crisis we have, we should probably give them like a seat at the table. Cece, this was an absolutely phenomenal conversation. I loved the points you brought up about really thinking about the future differently, much more expansively, at the same time empowering us to take ownership of the future and giving us very practical first steps on thinking about the future, but also keeping in mind to keep it practical and attainable, as in this is not just pie in the sky science fiction, like 1,000 years out type of thinking, but really about what can we do today to actually create that future which we might see. So thank you so much. We will put a link to your absolutely phenomenal company, Futurity Studio, into the show notes. Everybody should check that out. The work you're doing is incredible. You publish quite a bit of your work, which is awesome. So if you're interested, you should definitely follow Cece and her work and her team's work. That being said, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Pascal. That was super fun.
Hey, it's Pascal. Thanks for tuning in on this episode of Disrupt Disruption. If you want more, check out the other episodes we have on this podcast. And if you liked it, do us a favor. Go on your podcasting platform of choice, iTunes, Google Play, whatever it is, and leave a quick review. It helps tremendously with getting the insights from our guests out into the world. If you have any questions, send me an email. You can reach me at pascal@finet.com. Thank you so much for listening, and I will hear you here soon.